This is the 21st anniversary Jellicoe Literary Guild meeting. The Jellicoe Literary Guild was begun in 1988. Its first meeting, and many meetings thereafter, occurred in New Britain, Connecticut, at Roma Restaurant. Originally, it was a monthly group. It met once a month, and I think that happened throughout the first year, full year. Since it started in December of '88, it meant through all of '89 once a month. And then I tapered it down to 8 times a year. And for many years, for 13 years, there were 4 meetings in the spring and 4 meetings in the fall. And in 1992, I moved to the Boston area from Connecticut. So the meetings were, for the most part, ones in which I had to come down for them. And it also gave me a reason and a way to stay in touch with people that I was close with down in Connecticut. So I would get on the Greyhound bus, and that started in 1992, 3 years into the organization existence. And then in 95, I started the Senecal. So many meetings, I would be bringing down a Senecal that included contributions by people at the meeting because, frankly, those were all the people I knew. That was all I had. Good people, though. The meetings continued until December of 2001, when after 13 years I decided that it was time to conclude them. I decided the meetings had run their course. Roma Restaurant wasn't the place that it had been when we started meeting there. It really didn't have a back room anymore, a back dining room. The back dining room, they expanded it and turned it into a big pool hall. So there were tables, but there wasn't a sense of privacy or being away from things. It was more noisy, and new owners took over, and they really weren't very interested in what we were doing or why. But then, after thinking about it for many years, in 2008, with Cassie as my chief co-conspirator, we started having meetings again, and we had 6 meetings in 2008, and this is the second meeting of 2009, and this is the 21st anniversary. The first meeting was held on December 29th, 1988, so it's not quite to the day, but it is 21 years. And so that is the high overview of the Jellicoe Guild. I'm going to start with something I wrote for the New Senecal, number 71, December 2009. So I had to write this. I had to write it that day, Thursday. I didn't know where to go. It was lunchtime, and I thought, well, everywhere I go is going to be crowded. What I nearly really need is peace and quiet. What I really need is an armchair and peace and quiet. And I was lucky enough to find an armchair at the Hilton Hotel downtown. It's dated as though it's a letter, but it's not really a letter. I mean, it's not particularly a letter. December 17th, 2009, 12:52 p.m., Hilton Hotel Lounge, Portland, Oregon. I woke this morning realizing that the current decade is nearly over, 2 weeks from over. Not a lot of fanfare over this. It's been a dark, tiring time, and still. Wars large and small go on. The planet is still in ecological peril. Millions and millions are poor and sick, die in pain, die alone. Countless sit in prison for smoking the leaves of a benign plant. Someone, many someones, are plotting to harm you, take something from you, figure how to fool you into giving it away. Fat cats are purring louder. The human hustle goes ever on. Nobody knew 10 years ago what was to come. There were fears of dependence on technology, skepticism of the helping hand of government. Those days, those years of the late 1990s, bear a kind of lazy innocence to them in retrospect's view. Perhaps the current tumults will appear apple-cheeked smiling one day sooner or later. Then, now, hence. Nothing is as it seems. Someone is always plotting what next. How bombing that building, or stealing that election, or abducting that girl, or evicting that family, or one way or another, limiting the choice of another, will result in tasty victory. New leaders ever emerge, and their followers coalesce. One of the hardest questions about this world, both broad in its scope and profoundly applicable, is simply, are we as human beings evolving? This question breeds crazy once it's given attention. Evolving toward what? At different rates? Constantly, by fits and starts, sometimes devolving too? Is there an endpoint, an arrival? Accepting or allowing for the idea of human evolution can profoundly affect one's life, the history of one's culture, the direction of the world itself. One looks back and sees a from, and imagines forward too. A road, a path, days of progress, others of stall. Feeling good on a given night, hopeful, one says to another in conversation, "Well, Houston just elected a gay mayor, the first openly gay mayor of a major American city. And Washington, D.C. City Council passed a measure legalizing gay marriage. Oh, and the Obama administration isn't going to prosecute in states that allow medical marijuana." But the reply could easily be, "But the Congress is too bought and sold to pass universal health care, and our war in Afghanistan is expanding, and how many regions of the world are just this side of nuclear war?" What I come back to is a strange feeling of hope, not despair, in the unknown times ahead. The future is an infinite feast of possibilities, great ones and tragic ones, and I do not believe that anyone has taken sure control of this feast. That said, the idea of evolution cannot help but be a messy, sometimes incoherent thing. The feast of the future covers the world, and not every dish is sweet. Some dishes are empty, some bear poisons, some dishes are larger than others. But your place at the feast, mine? None can say beyond this moment, this never fully knowable now. Whether or not the world's constant movement is synonymous with evolution or not quite, the world is constantly moving. Look back to December 1999, and none can say otherwise. Scripter Press has certainly evolved in the past 10 years. 10 years ago, I still lived in the Boston area, was still in graduate school, had little use of or knowledge of computers, though I had worked in a computer bookstore and taken classes in desktop publishing. It was during this decade that I came to see and to embrace the great potentials coming to pass. I still do my most meaningful writing like this with a black pen and lined paper, yet I know that these words may one day soon be read online by someone in a physically distant part of the world. That I can scan this page, integrate it into an electronic copy of this journal, and upload it to a server where others can quote-unquote visit to obtain a copy. Two, that some of these far-flung souls might one day become friends and contribute work to this journal and receive in the mail a print copy produced in my home. Some of the words in this journal have and will be heard on my radio show, broadcast around the world. Electronic transmission of words, images, and sounds has become commonplace. I call this an evolution in my life and that of billions of others on this planet, a victory on the path. And yet, still the world is in peril, still many sit in prisons, still the poor, still the sick, still the purr of fat cats and a million schemes underway to control the flow of evolution, to own the future. I don't believe we will ever evolve out of these kinds of conflicts. Who can marry whom? Who deserves to heal with best care? I believe the human impulse to know and do is too complex and malleable to chain to a way, a single truth. I even think that we've survived as a species this long because of the fluidity in our beings. What I cannot say, what none can say, is whether what has gotten us here will ever carry us along. Our preachers, our presidents, our poets, our madmen, our purring fat cats do not know. Maybe this is reason to smile in the season of lights. Nobody knows what's to come better than you or I do. There's still a chance. The feast is raging on.
I'm starting with a piece called The Optimism of Uncertainty by Howard Zinn. It's from a book called The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear, edited by Paul Roget-Loeb. In this awful world where the efforts of caring people often pale in comparison to what is done by those who have power, how do I manage to stay involved and seemingly happy? Some quick lessons. Don't let, quote, those who have power, end quote, intimidate you. No matter how much power they have, they cannot prevent you from living your life, thinking independently, speaking your mind. Find people to be with who share your values and commitments and who also have a sense of humor. Understand that the major media will not tell you of all the acts of resistance taking place every day in the society. The strikes, protests, individual acts of courage in the face of authority. Look around and you will certainly find it, for the evidence of those unreported acts. And for the little you find, extrapolate from that and assume there must be 1,000 times as much as you found. Note that throughout history, people have felt powerless before authority, but that at certain times, these powerless people, by organizing, acting, risking, persisting, have created enough power to change the world around them, even if a little. That is the history of the labor movement, the women's movement, the anti-Vietnam movement, the disabled persons movement, the gay and lesbian movement, the movement of black people in the South. Remember that those who have power and seem invulnerable are in fact quite vulnerable. Their power depends on the obedience of others, and when those others begin withholding that obedience, begin defying authority, that power at the top turns out to be very fragile. Generals become powerless when their soldiers refuse to fight. Industrialists become powerless when their workers leave their jobs or occupy the factories. When we forget the fragility of that power at the top, we become astounded when it crumbles in the face of rebellion. We have had many such surprises in our time, both in the United States and in other countries. Don't look for a moment of total triumph. See engagement as an ongoing struggle with victories and defeats, but in the long run, slow progress. So you need patience and persistence. Understand that even when you don't win, there is fun and fulfillment in the fact that you have been involved with other good people in something worthwhile. Worthwhile. You need hope. Is an optimist necessarily a blithe, slightly sappy whistler in the dark of our time? I am totally confident not that the world will get better, but that only confidence can prevent people from giving up the game before all the cards have been played. The metaphor is deliberate. Life is a gamble. Not to play is to foreclose any chance of winning. To play, to act, is to create at least a possibility of changing the world. What leaps out from the history of the past 100 years is its utter unpredictability. This confounds us because we are talking about exactly the period when human beings became so ingenious technologically that they could plan and predict the exact time of someone landing on the moon or walk down the street talking to someone halfway around the earth. Now I'm going to skip ahead because then he starts talking about all things in history. So I'm going to skip to his conclusion. One semester when I was teaching, I learned that there were several classical musicians signed up in my course. For the last class of the semester, I stood aside while they sat in the chairs up front and played a Mozart quartet. Not a customary finale to a class in political theory, but I wanted the class to understand that politics is pointless if it does nothing to enhance the beauty of our lives. Political discussion can sour you. We needed some music. Revolutionary change does not come as one cataclysmic moment, beware of such moments, but as an endless succession of surprises moving zigzag toward a more decent society. We don't have to engage in grand heroic actions to participate in the process of change. Small acts, when multiplied by millions of people, can transform the world. To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, And there are so many where people have behaved magnificently. This gives us the energy to act and at least the possibility of sending the spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presents, and to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory.
Howard Zinn. So the last time you met, I read from the first 30 of Mini Music's fifth series, which I explained was a series that I determined I was going to write personal poems. So for the last 2 months, I've been writing personal poems. What's left of prayer? The beast within roars his boneless frail. From his roar, a strong song, a cry to trees and moon. Of his frail, the night's crushed, the wet shame. The lesson that any hour may lift, the lesson that any hour may suddenly choke. I sat here and nowhere, and I writhed. Angel Leary. It's a play on Kelly Angel Leary's last name, but I thought it was a funny play. I met you 20 years ago today on a mountain path. You were dark-haired and dark-eyed and smilingly curvaceously pretty. You gamely threw and caught a football with our group of hikers. There was another, too, but I chose you. Our first dawn, you slept on my couch. I kissed you and lay on the floor below. You were a teacher in training, new to the area. I think you liked me well enough. I think it was better than being a young woman alone. Thanksgiving morning, you talked of marriage, and I didn't know then how close to it you'd already been. Such talk ended when your mother learned I was a grad school dropout, working at a coffee shop, and that my family's genes were tainted. But when you brought me to her mansion's door, I should have known. I was no more bound to last in your life than a temporary teaching gig in a fallen factory town. The happy autumn became the sad winter, became the despairing spring. It was over. Strangely, something lingered. Hearts are not chess pieces. Bodies remember words and touch, a clumsy laugh, the obsessed gestures of the forlorn and true. When you moved far, I took planes to see you, share your meals again, drive around your next home. The light we shared and made faded as months passed. Your yearn turned another way, other eyes, other hands. I moved on, too, because I was still young and the beast in me dragged me through the worst hours, would not let me off the humble path. 20 years ago, each of us lonely on a mountain path, I never climbed it again. Poor Raymond. Octopus tree at Cape Mears. A much happier topic. This Sitka has no central trunk. Branches root out in all directions, causing some to have likened it to a candelabra. 'Tis also said that the natives would bring their fallen chiefs in burial boats to this tree, the council tree, set the boat amongst its arms, and let the wind and tides take them onward. Do men need the mystery or its explanation more? Pink noise. It was a pink noise I woke with and heard on the shore today. The piles of kelp drying, the furious tidal play. The sun consuming its final hour and pulling down all the lights with a gasp. A power that stirs, that drives, that lives as one and by millions. It was a pink noise that kept me into the dark. Ways of the waves. Some waves don't reach the shore, don't get even close. They rise, royal, roll out their stretch. Then the rest take them back. In their time of sun, there is something each sees, feels, touch of wild air, sight of the others, near and far, that have pushed to surface and tossed into light. The ones who reach the shore carry the kelp, the driftwood, the soft and boneless creatures. Above there are gulls or herons in their ragged formation and ruckus chatter. There's gift in this twist of a moment, of being something in this world, giving something to this world, and feeling its sure recall when the best has been spent. Sometimes capitulation. When the night cried back, in all its colors and conflations, its calliope of sensations and mysteries was flesh, chemistry, consciousness, the cage, the playing field. What tools made for these were tools made for an old war. Romance no longer in the song, but by mastery of the singing. And defiance. There is always that moment, that breath, when the flesh's hungers retreat a moment. Chemistry slaves neither next option. When Will floats, a nod, a shake, what led here, how the world looks right now, something in it, this, mine, what, I ask, and do not know. It will never get easier than tonight and this hour. Make that move, use your bones, use your mind, use that breath in you like it invents the world, every single one. Use that breath in you like it invents the world new, every single one. Sometimes I trick myself with my phraseologies. What left? My prayer of healing and song to you from this far, between us the many hours, still mysteries of lightless places and tongues unknown by men. My prayer of healing because I lose too if you fall, give in. And if you do not, my reward is nothing and everything, both. I don't know where that came from. More feedback. There was a movement in the shadow, a flash of pink, a breath, a word. Maybe it was like the gesture that commenced to create the stars. Maybe it was the men herd feeding, brutal and half aware. But you and I alike make the choice what to heed. The masters to their duty, the slaves to their dance. This next one's called Screen Burn. Again you arrived to my dreams, nearly 20 years since I last saw you, and yet here you are. I squirm and struggle for your heart. Remember that night we seemed about to, we didn't, and then hours became years, and the world of my love for you sunk deeper within. But here you are again, still 17, still perfect, and you smile at me. Stricken anew, I nod, and I follow. Wage slave, I would not work for you, but these bars I did not build, nor can pull down my own. I might work beside you if it could be said we make something, a good day's sweat from it. No. What I build for you is a higher pile of dead hours none will retrieve, and the only difference I can see is that your dead hours pay for life's shiny things, and mine pay for these angry lines of art. And this one is unabashedly for Kessing. Rare instances where I write love poems. The moment I knew I loved you was high and deep in a desert's night, when I saw the shift among worlds would take you and I by each other for a short time more, and I must bid you jump or let you go. You jumped my joy. New fiction. The hunger that everything matters, however casual a hand touches a hand by night. Words without echo, without memory, yet this hour, how it wilds to possess the world. I wonder as it passes, its music become another and another. Wonder without why what this was, the avenue lights flaring, traffic's hard hustling drama, and the soft remove to dreams, if removed at all. The next one's called Nihil, and it's not a very good poem. If a fucks that all is all that's to it, feed, breed, continue the kind, is this good? Is it yet good enough? Crippled, one sits alone in a half-lit room, undone by the fleeing taste of sweet. The noise of the street sighs abates. What's next, the spirit asks. What will you do? How to take that first new step toward past memory? I dream of guns often and wonder at this, sometimes on an old car seat, sometimes in a policeman's hand. One time in an office, used by a security guard to keep me in sight, move me around. I suppose the gun, those seen and those felt around, guards the hour, patrols the rich man's keep of golden coin and fine ass, lets the rest know that we're tending the steering of a boat not our own, and that these controls existed when guns were yet sharpened rocks, and will exist on when men guard and direct other men by harnessing starlight itself. Sparkling lights. No perfection, all perfection, the grime and glow of the hours. Not a dream to solve, a music to salve, nothing but the world-crusted mind, its unsorted well of crying memories, the chance in every direction, the fleeing, luring chance, come along, it says, a guru, a demon, a bloom, a soft voice, come along before it passes, it passes, it passes. So this one I wrote upon arriving at work one morning. I had the opening two sentences or lines or whatever in my head, and I just decided I better just go for it right then and there. Self-portrait. Portrait spelled oddly. I climb inside my mind and start to root around. I climb inside my own mind, and here is what I found. A beat-up orange football of foam, a headless plastic horse, a few wrinkled Playboy magazines, a room at least of books, countless thrift store notebooks with filled pages like this one, 1,000 movie stubs, 1,000 scratched LPs, the beat clothes of a tall man never pretty to himself. I find the flowing image of a woman continuous in every shadow on every wall, and a want, want, want radiating about her, and the only question I have as a frame, do I want her heart or her cunt more? There are children who never grow up in here, every crippled, ever needful, and splotches all around them of crying guilt and hardened love, and both of these are not mine, but invaded me long ago and will not part me till I blow into the wind. There are voices, just voices, preserved from long dead years. They mock my hair, my height, the shoes I wear, the very smell of my tired, confused, unkempt body as I grope among them in markets and classrooms. And there are trees, millions of trees, and a moon above, and great concert of stars, and there are a mountain, and over there are the sea, and sometimes all of this seems gone to me, like only men and their savage waking blood exists at all. There are demons too, and we regard each other, and I say who, what, and they say you and others, many others, every other. When will you know? I say I wish, they say let be. We nod, we smile, there is chasm, there is hope. And last my pen, this pen, many before it, many to come, and this page and this hour, and I am inside my mind, which looks like and not like this world. I breathe, relax, a beat, another. These words are my music, how I tell of life, and they shine in my mind, so all told here may stand revealed, and the room for so much more yet to come. Vicious gone. A beast in me, a beast in you, a beast roars from the heart of this world. A beast roars out this world, and each of us its cry, its horror at what its song looks like. This world its song, the beast who cries out this world. Lawless, because laws only name the chaos without knowing or owning it. Lawless, because before then, before now, before order, before death. Lawless, because the beast cries and his cry both, and I am crying too. I am crying now for how much I will never know. Every confession. You are all my brothers, every last angel and bastard of you, and the trees and unseen forests, and the moonlight on ocean waves 1,000 miles from land. All my brothers, those living tonight, 1,000 years ago, and 1,000 years to come. You are all my brothers, not because mystics and physics tell me so, not because the dust I am once formed many other things, and will again in what great Huron that I will know otherwise, not even because my dust is yours. You are all my brothers because this blood in me is the sea, and the sea covers the world like a beautiful swath, and there is stardust in my bones, and stars sing over the world like a first and last lullaby, and you are all my brothers because even in dreams you are there, and what best hope I have of hereafter is resting or dancing with you all. God. The woman smiled and moved like flesh made music on her bed, smiled as a few garments, and then a fewer. The garments were clouds, and she was the sky. So when they cleared, the sky now clear, her body smiling and nude, I said, God, we invented you to explain ourselves to each other. She smiled and moved again, and we invented, and you explained, but nothing, nothing explains. All one flesh. The lean and lure toward one end and the other, a tan-facing candlelight, a thin book that points to trees. But then all are one, a steely union in spirit and unto earth. Somewhere down low and in between is the moving word, the laughing light, the doubtful dance best men of faith do in plain hours. Okay, what I learned today. This actually sort of began from an incident on my walking to work. A man walked by me and asked me to buy him a sandwich, and I said, why don't you have a job? And he started telling me a story about sleeping in the gutter and having his wallet stolen and so on and so forth. And I was listening. I was like, and then he passed me and I said, you want to keep talking? I'll keep listening. He kept going. I said, it's your choice. If you want to keep talking, I'll keep listening. But anyway, whatever. It went on from there. A ragged man on the street passes me and begs a sandwich. I ask why, but nothing, he says, explains. I pass a woman and her friend considering how much money next year. The light red to green, and I have to get on eventually to the tall building. The pisser full of men. I listen from a stall. One man has such a bad back, the other does too. And when at last all is still, I remember listening to the leader of men saying his new war speech crushed him inside. A smiling girl in a short skirt, hot ass, dying heart, a broken bicycle frame, crushed to a tree, rains all night. Train through city December. Rains all night, the way's disillusion. I walk upright, hurting my musics, and a sometimes sagging heart. I see faces struggle in the season of lights, what it is, what to do, how to shock themselves to happiness. Mama Papa. In this crimson chamber where heart beats memory, each breath a dream, I sit with you again, forlorn and true, and I ask, why did you make me? What love did you know? Where is this place? Will I come again to be? The healing. Inside the truth, there is no preaching. There are still the doubts besetting all men, but wearing a stinging belt of hope, one begins to work. But what if the truth is double, is many, and doubt shines more sexy, offers play when the work is too much, sings happy of moving from lazy faith to lazy faith? What if nothing holds too long in the primal shiftings of both world and soul? Better ask, why the ceaseless dance of beaten breath? Why the key chased through layers of dream? Why the healing and new touch? The mystery again so close. Sentience all. You come to me in voices, or maybe one great braided voice, a drop pencil, a scrap of lettuce, the sheen on wet cobblestones, voices, braided voice, a cry I cannot know but to feel, an urging that I can connect not just among men but among all. The need of the world from its cells to its peaks for attention, care, healing, and no cry of weakness, no bent despair in this, an instruction. Yes, take the yellow groping of your heart, the shaped doubts you wreck faith. Yes, take the inky wants you call your songs, but listen, nearer. Crack the brambled world of men, its heights and cities of dirty mirrors. You come to me in voices, or maybe one great braided voice. Dolls in a junk heap, old terminals, fallen oak walls, another's long memory of a deep wound. And for a moment, become plain and ferocious, and say, when will you learn to arrive at this hour, and a thousand more like it, just to spark and begin? Frenzied faith. For the tall buildings feed me the despair, and the green things feed me their mystery, and my dreams feed me raw instructions, and flesh feeds my jerky dance. Flesh's want feeds my jerky dance, and I wonder how to make it all music, and I don't know how to remember, how to know I know. Psychedelic Dream 5. This is the fifth in a subseries of poems. Psychedelic Dream series. What?
Ongoing subseries.
In that dream, or high, or song, I held my pen and looked at the page, and nothing came. I sit very close, hunched into my pages, let the music in my ears swathe my mind, let the desert's long, full moonbeams, let the ocean's wild, fecund hustle, let the woods replace my bones, tree up my body, let the sun break me into a thousand rays, let the love jingle my mind and the pain trouble my beat and breath, and I didn't stop, and I haven't stopped, and I will not stop because something listens. Something needs this. And finally, every one of these series has ended in a long poem. And all I know about this poem is it was going to be called Season of Lights, because a long time ago I had a conception called Season of Lights. And I had it for a long time, and then I kind of lost it because I thought, well, it's too derived from organized religion. And lately I've been thinking, no, if you want to make something your own, then make it your own. You know, but really make it your own. You know, make it more your own as you go on. So I didn't know, I had no clue where I was going with this, but it was the last one, and I had lots of notes, and I just wanted to, hit it. It wasn't years ago like many of these stories, no. There was no full moon as often as my light. I'm not telling one more story of finance and tryptamines because I can. These are my hours. This is what I do with them. There was pain, but it was not the stuff of music, and I caused as much as I got. Was it reaction? Was it revenge? What isn't in this world one way or another? But there it was, not long ago enough to be long ago, merely ago. I sat alone with many others, and these were neither friends nor enemies. And I worked, and we worked, and nothing we made mattered. These hours weren't even pretty enough to be ugly. What then about this? Why remember it to this page? It was because I looked up, suddenly, and nobody saw me do it. Looked up at something. Was it an insect flashing by, tiny and up here on the 20th floor? It was, and nobody noticed, but I did not look down. I watched it, this visible buzzing. Watched it for how it did not belong here, and yet here it was. Dissatisfied, thrown, now restless to know more. Yet what book, or which teacher, what great human path of knowing would explain? None. I knew this. None would explain. That's how I ended up here. None explains. And for a long time it hadn't mattered anymore. I had my work, alone and among others. I had a chamber, a cupboard of food, a deck of cards, and a body to fuck every night. None explained, but I no longer knew or cared. Now I did, and I had to know, or at least I had to look again new, and so I stood up and left my desk, my work, and climbed the 20 flights down to the street, a mid-morning of drizzle and hustlers with begging signs. I walked the streets thinking, how do I unlearn all I no longer know? How do I do this? I'm telling you about something still fresh, not an old tale with all that came after. No, none explains, but I had to know. And so I sit here with before you, no cup, no line to pedal. I sit before you on this street corner, a shout's distance from that great tree of lights, and I do not know, none explains. But I ask you now, sit with me. Sit here with me a minute, an hour. We don't have to speak. Sit with me. We'll look at the lights. We'll watch the faces. We'll wonder high and low because that's what humans do. We don't have to speak, but we may find we are singing. We'll feel the drizzle, the great miracle of doubt, and the love. Dave Eggers?
Eggers. Yeah. I'm going to read the beginning of a heartbreaking work of staggering genius. Through the small, tall bathroom window, the December yard is gray and scratchy, the trees calligraphic. Calligraphic. Exhaust from the dryer billows out of the house and up, breaking apart while tumbling into the white sky. The house is a factory. I put my pants back on and go back to my mother. I walk down the hall, past the laundry room, and into the family room. I close the door behind me, muffling the rumbling of the small shoes in the dryer. Where were you? My mother says. In the bathroom, I say. Humph, she says. What? For 15 minutes? It wasn't that long. It was longer. Was something broken? No. Did you fall in? No. Were you playing with yourself? I was cutting my hair. You were contemplating your navel. Right, whatever. Did you clean up? Yeah. I had not cleaned up. Had actually left hair everywhere, twisted brown doodles drawn in the sink, but knew that my mother would not find out. She could not get up to check. My mother is on the couch. At this point, she does not move from the couch. There was a time, until a few months ago, when she was still up and about, walking and driving, running errands. After that, there was a period when she spent most of her time in her chair, the one next to the couch, occasionally doing things, going out, whatnot. Finally, she moved to the couch, but even then, for a while at least, while spending most of her time on the couch, every night at 11 p.m. or so, she had made a point of making her way up the stairs in her bare feet, still tan brown in November, slow and careful, on the green carpet, to my sister's old bedroom. She had been sleeping there for years. The room was pink and clean, and the bed had a canopy. And long ago, she resolved that she could no longer sleep with my father's coughing. But the last time she went upstairs was weeks ago. Now she is on the couch, not moving from the couch, reclining on the couch during the day and sleeping there at night, in her nightgown, with the TV on until dawn, a comforter over her toe to neck. People know. While reclining on the couch most of the day and night, on her back, my mom turns her head to watch television and turns it back to spit up green fluid into a plastic receptacle. The plastic receptacle is new. For many weeks, she has been spitting the green fluid into a towel, not the same towel, but a rotation of towels, one of which she would keep on her chest. But the towel on her chest, my sister Beth and I found out after a short while, was not such a good place to spit the green fluid because, as it turned out, the green fluid smelled awful, much more pungent in aroma than one might expect. Parentheses, one expects some sort of order, sure, but this, in parentheses. And so the green fluid could not be left there, festering and then petrifying on the terry cloth towels because the green fluid hardened to a crust on the terry cloth towels. They were almost impossible to clean, so the green fluid towels were one use only. And even if used, every corner of the towel, folding and turning, turning and folding, they would only last a few days each, and the supply was running short, even after we plundered the bathrooms, closets, garage. So finally, Beth procured, and our mother began to spit the green fluid into a small plastic container which looked makeshift, like a piece of an air conditioning unit, but had been provided by the hospital, and it was, as far as we knew, designed for people who do a lot of spitting up of green fluid. It's a molded plastic receptacle, cream-colored, in the shape of a half moon, which can be kept handy and spit into. It can be cupped around the mouth of a reclining person, just under the chin, in a way that allows the depositor of green bodily fluids to either raise one's head to spit directly into it, or to simply let the fluid dribble down over his or her chin, and then into the receptacle waiting below. It was a great find, the half moon plastic receptacle. That thing is handy, huh? I asked my mom, walking past her toward the kitchen. Yeah, it's the cat's meow, she says. I get a popsicle from the refrigerator and come back to the family room. They took my mother's stomach out about 6 months ago. At that point, there wasn't a lot left to remove. They had already taken out, I would use the medical terms here if I knew them, the rest of it about a year before. But then they tied the something to the something, hoped that they had removed the offending portion, and set her on a schedule of chemotherapy, but of course they didn't get it all. They had left some of it and it had grown, it had come back, it had laid eggs, was stowed away, was stuck to the side of the spaceship. She had seemed good for a while, had done the chemo, had gotten the wigs, and then her hair had grown back, darker, more brittle. But 6 months later she began to have pain again. Was it indigestion? It could just be indigestion, of course, the burping and the pain, the leaning over the kitchen table at dinner. People have indigestion, people take Tums. Hey mom, should I get some Tums? But when she went in again, they had opened her up, a phrase they use, and looked inside. It was staring out at them, at the doctors, like 1,000 writhing worms under a rock, swarming, shimmering, wet and oily. Good God. Or maybe not like worms, but like 1,000,000 little podules, each a tiny city of cancer, each with an unruly, sprawling, environmentally careless citizenry with no zoning laws whatsoever. When the doctor opened her up and there was suddenly light thrown upon the world of cancer podules, they were annoyed by this disturbance and defiant. Turn off the fucking light. They glared at the doctor, each podule, though a city into itself, having one single eye, one blind evil eye in the middle, which stared imperiously as only a blind eye can do, out at the doctor. Go the fuck away. The doctors did what they could, took the whole stomach out, connected what was left, this part to that, and sewed her back up, leaving the city as is, the colonists to their manifest destiny, their fossil fuels, their strip malls, and suburban sprawl. Replaced the stomach with a tube and a portable external IV bag. It's kind of cute, the IV bag. She used to carry it with her in a gray backpack. Kind of futuristic looking. Like a synthetic ice pack crossed with those liquid food patches engineered for space travel. We have a name for it. We call it the bag. My mother and I are watching TV. It's the show where young amateur athletes with day jobs in marketing and engineering compete in sports of strength and agility against male and female bodybuilders. The bodybuilders are mostly blonde and are impeccably tanned. They look great. They have names that sound fast and indomitable, names like American Cars and Electronics, like Firestar and Mercury and Zenith. It's a great show. What is this? She asked, leaning toward the TV. Her eyes, once small, sharp, intimidating, are now dull, yellow, droopy, strained. The spitting gives them a look of constant exasperation. The fighting show thing, I say. She says, then turns, lifts her head to spit. Is it still bleeding? I ask, sucking on my popsicle. Yeah. We're having a nosebleed. While I was in the bathroom, she was holding the nose, but she can't hold it tight enough, so now I relieve her. pinching her nostrils with my free hand. Her skin is oily and smooth. Hold it tighter, she says. Okay, I say, and hold it tighter. Her skin is hot. Toph's shoes continue to rumble in the dryer.
I am going to read from my Notes from Northwest. Next. Beginning with an epigraph from Rachel Carson, Sea Around Us. Fish, amphibian, and reptile, warm-blooded bird and mammal, each of us carries in our veins a salty stream in which the elements sodium, potassium, and calcium are combined in almost the same proportions as in seawater. This is our inheritance from the day, untold millions of years ago, when a remote ancestor, having progressed from the one-celled to the many-celled stage, first developed a circulatory system in which the fluid was merely water of the sea. Begin these notes with the ocean. A moment, an hour, a day by its side. Katie is taking pictures. I am sitting on a log of driftwood near the water's edge writing. It is a high day. For many reasons. Neither of us have been to the ocean in years, never together. We've gotten a hotel near Tillamook, Oregon, home of a famous dairy factory, cheese, milk, ice cream. This day, Halloween perchance, we packed our bag of food, cameras, and notebooks and came down to the water. Chilly but no rain. Dogs and humans roam the shore familiarly, many we guess from the fancy houses on the hilltop behind us. Oregon's Pacific shores are free to all, a right, a mercy. Primal, all this. The herons and gulls fly by, the driftwood and kelp drying on sand, sun, the clouds. Confronting the ocean simplifies things. Here is mystery made visible. Here is power. Here is beauty. Here, too, is vulnerability. The finite limits of the planet's epic reserves to support life. It takes me a long time to really settle. Our sandwiches taste soggy. I take turns with Katie snapping pictures. We walk and walk some more. Finally, I sit. I listen. A rhythmic music, the sound of this wet world breathing. Visible evidence of how alive the earth itself is, and how a body as far away as the moon exerts effect. I wonder, is all of this proof of God's hand, or the shape of that hand itself? In truth, I find I need no proof, nor does the idea of God interest me. Whatever all of this is, where from, where bound, here it is now. The fact of this world, whatever larger thing it beds in, whatever clock or rules it may operate by, the challenge is to shape one's faith complementary to one's questions, so each may breathe and flourish like this shore. I write and write because I came here to open my pores wider than in a while. When the light begins to leave, Katie and I return to the view deck near our hotel. We take pictures, especially of a large heron standing unmoving in a puddle, a ways from the sea itself as the tide recedes. The trick seems to be to clasp hands tightly with and live by the idea that our home counts for herons and humans and kelp and driftwood and all the rest alike. Oh, what a trick. We watch the sunset as its calliope of colors breaks and remakes our heart. Not just the moon and its gravity, but the sun and its heat electrifying this world with life. The mysteries stretch ever outward, one affecting another, each many, many all, one in many in all. The hungry eye, the questing soul looks upward and does not see dead stars, but live light. Every night its arriving message, its reassurance that there is room enough in this universe and however many others for each to look deeper and deeper in and then turn, by hope or despair or both, outward, a single animate might on a noisy little rock, but also more, so much more, ever more, and still ever more. Without answers, not even hours or even a minute's certainty gained by our experiences, we nonetheless retreat to our motel room as two of the blessed, bearing high gifts that urge play, work, gratefulness, love, a proofless trust to keep breathing.
It's called Poetry and Commitment. Adrienne Rich, recipient of the National Book Foundation's Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. It's an essay. It's in a tiny little book. Poetry and Commitment was first presented as the plenary lecture at the 2006 Conference on Poetry and Politics, Stirling University, Scotland. Adrienne Rich read a brief revision on the occasion of accepting the National Book Foundation Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. So, it's a
speech.
Orally presented essay, or as some may call it, a speech.
It's a speech. It's a lecture. She's a teacher. She wrote a lecture.
She calls it an essay.
Fair enough. She took her ideas and she put them in written form.
A tiny, nice little book.
It's a very nice little book.
Yeah. So I'm reading, I don't know why it's divided into sections really, but it's section 4. I'm both a poet and one of the everybodies of my country. I live in poetry and daily experience with manipulated fear, ignorance, cultural confusion, and social antagonism huddling together on the fault line of an empire. In my lifetime, I've seen the breakdown of rights and citizenship where ordinary everybodies, poets or not, have left politics to a political class bent on shoveling the elemental resources, the public commons of the entire world, into private control. Where democracy has been left to the rating of acknowledged legislators, the highest bidders. In short, to a criminal element. Ordinary, comfortable Americans have looked aside when our fraternally twinned parties, Democrat and Republican, have backed dictatorships against popular movements abroad, as their covert agencies through torture and assassination, through supplied weapons and military training, have propped up repressive parties and regimes in the name of anti-communism and our, quote, national interests. Why did we think fascistic methods, the subversion of civil and human rights, would be contained somewhere else? Because as a nation, we've clung to a self-righteous false innocence, eyes shut to our own scenario, our body politics' internal bleeding. This is quite a tirade to be reading for a frail old woman. But internal bleeding is no sudden symptom. That uncannily prescient African-American writer James Baldwin asked his country a quarter century ago, "If you don't know him, my father, how can you know the people in the streets of Tehran?" This year, a report from the Bureau of Justice Statistics finds that one out of every 136 residents of the United States is behind bars, many in jails, unconvicted. That the percentage of black men in prison or jail is almost 12-1 over white male prisoners, that the states with the highest rates of incarceration and execution are those with the poorest populations. We often hear that, by contrast with, say, Nigeria or Egypt, China, or the former Soviet Union, the West doesn't imprison dissident writers. But when a nation's criminal justice system imprisons so many, often on tawdry evidence and botched due process, to be tortured in maximum security units or on death row, overwhelmingly because of color and class, it is in effect and intention silencing potential and actual writers, intellectuals, artists, journalists, a whole intelligentsia. The internationally known case of Mumia Abu-Jamal is emblematic but hardly unique. The methods of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo have long been practiced in the prisons and policing of the United States. What has all this to do with poetry? Would we have come here from so many directions to such a conference if all this had nothing to do with poetry? We can also imagine others who might be here if not for the collision of politics with literature. In the words of Brecht's Galileo, addressed to scientists in a newly commercial age but equally challenging for artists, what are we working for? But let's never discount it. Within every official statistical designated nation, there breathes another nation of unappointed, unappeased, unacknowledged clusters of people who daily, with fierce imagination and tenacity, confront cruelties, exclusions, and indignities, signaling through those barriers, which are often literal cages in poetry, music, street theater, murals, videos, websites, and through many forms of direct activism.
Something comes in. <It's just laughs> really she's gotten into a good mood. Everything's fucked. But wait a minute.
And this keeps happening. I began making notes for this talk last March on a day of cold wind flattened while light overhanging the coast. Flattened white light overhanging the coast where I live, raining for almost a month, a numbing sense of dead-end, endless winter, endless war. In the last week of March, a punitive and cynical anti-immigrant bill is introduced in Congress and passed by the House of Representatives. As most of you know, essential sectors of the Western economies depend on the low-wage labor and social vulnerability of economic refugees, especially in the United States from south of the border.
I don't think it actually passed as
long. I don't think so.
Bush was actually not against immigrants. It was one of his few positive traits that
I think
he wasn't
coming from
immigrant.
Texas, yeah.
He had an understanding.
Yep. That bill would make it a felony not just to employ, but to give medical aid, even food or water, to a, quote, illegal immigrant. Between the United States and Mexico, a walled, armed border would turn back those economic refugees. The hypocrisy and flagrant racism of that bill arouses a vast population. Community leaders put out the word, call the Spanish-language radio stations to announce protest gatherings. Suddenly, though such events are never really sudden, a massive series of oppositional marches pours into the streets of Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Detroit, Atlanta, Denver, Houston, and other large and smaller cities and towns. The largest demonstrations in the history of many of those cities. Not only people from Mexico and Central America, but immigrant groups from Asia, Africa, the Caribbean, the Philippines, from Arab American communities, families, students, activists, unions, clergy, many at risk of firing or deportation opposing that bill. Millions of people, a working class movement different from earlier movements, a new articulation of dignity and solidarity, and a new politicized generation growing in part out of those marches, in, for example, a coalition of young Latinos and African Americans. Of course, there's the much larger political resistance heating up. Let me simply mention Chiapas, Seattle, Buenos Aires, Genoa, Porto Alegre, Caracas, Mumbai, the streets of Paris, and other European cities, not to mention worldwide women's and indigenous peoples' movements, which have never gone away, and the gay and lesbian liberation movements allied with and often emerging from these.
Death of a Rebel, A Biography of Phil Oakes by Mark Elliott. Came out in 89. Okay, so the only thing you need to know about this that gets explained, but I think it's better to know it ahead of time, is that, so Phil Oakes was a folk singer. He never quite made it big. He made records, and some of them were like, but fame eluded him. And finally he got dropped by his record label. Turned to drink and drugs and, like, just bad stuff. His record label dropped him in 1970. So he'd been making albums from the 50s and 60s, and then he just got dropped. He just has such a beautiful voice. So anyway, okay, so to appreciate this prologue, since I haven't read beyond it, but I'm sure it's good, in the 70s, he was just sort of getting by, doing this and that. And toward the end of his life, which he hanged himself, yeah, he started calling himself John Train. T-R-A-N, T-R-A-I-N, like a choo-choo train. And so...
Like, that's what he went by, or...
Well, okay, but that'll become more apparent in this prologue, but I just wanted to note that. That if it's not clear here, it's somewhat implied here. It's somewhat implied that you want... Like, it's sort of kind of understood that you know that before you read this thing, so that's why I'm saying it. They start lining up along West 3rd Street at 7 o'clock. By 7:15, they are beyond McDonald's, nearing the corner. Inside, Train sits at one end of the bar drinking orange juice with rum. The phone rings constantly. He picks up the receiver and tells them to come down for the second show, midnight. They might just be able to get in. Mike Porco shakes his head from side to side as he rinses a beer mug in the gray, swarmy dishwater. With him behind the bar is Barry, Mike's best bartender, a sexy titty chick, with a thin gold chain wrapped around her shiny naked belly. She hates Train. She makes him ask two, maybe three times for another drink. Rose is at the service end setting up the cherries. Ice spills over the tin bucket. It's going to be like the old days. Lots of music, lots of drinking. Waiting for Train by the stage are two men, grizzly t-shirted. Their function is to supply Train with orange juice and rum every 4 minutes. The drinks are important. The ice numbs Train's throat. He believes the alcohol makes it easier for him to hit the high notes. Phil Oakes went to Africa at one point for some reason, and he was assaulted, and it damaged his vocal cords, so he was never able to sing the same way. So I think this is presumed to be taking place after that, where he's just paranoid and drunk. Crazy. Yeah. 8 o'clock, showtime, the house is packed. The waitresses are having trouble getting to the service station. Porco is everywhere, replacing stock, taking tickets, seating people, cracking... This sounds like Victor. Yeah. Cracking seals on scotch quarts. This is the kind of thing you'd like reading. Cracking seals on scotch quarts and squeezing cork-bottomed tips into their necks. Every few minutes, Porco squints toward the stage to see who's on. Phil Oakes had promised to fill the evening with his friends. Porco wonders if all those who have sung so far are really, in fact, Phil's friends, or just a bunch of singers trying to score a set. Another hour crawls by before train reaches the stage. So fat with his stomach starting around his chest and underbellying beneath his dungaree zipper, his face a dead man's, strands of greasy, colorless hair drooping through the scarecrow hat on his head, his eyes arrogantly unfocused. Train's mission now is to introduce young Sammy Walker, a singer he's discovered. Walker, young and shy, comes to the mic, strums a few notes, then slips into song. The audience greets him warmly. Encouraged, Walker introduces Phil Oakes and Sis Cunningham to help with Song for Patty. By now, Train is pissed drunk. With drink in hand, he begins to speak. His words come in spurts, haunted by the familiar stutter. Okay, now we have a song about Patty Hearst. Now, I, for one, I'm not a fan of Patty Hearst myself. I don't know who she is. She could be a revolutionary like Sammy thinks she is. She could be a triple agent like the girl who killed Che Guevara. Her name was Tanya. Che Guevara was killed by some cunt who turned him into the CIA and KGB, who found him in Bolivia and killed him because of her. They killed her immediately, but it took a while to kill him. Patty Hearst was called Tanya. It's like a CIA code word. His running eyes are darting everywhere. The audience is silent. She's probably a double agent. Bobby Dylan tried to write a song about Patty Hearst, but he failed. I was too afraid of who she might be, so I wouldn't dare write a song about Patty Hearst without taking a stand. He said, look, we'll meet at the Holocaust Valley. He'll, the burning place where they burn people. Sis Cunningham steps to the mic and says smilingly, it comes out in the song. The audience laughs with relief. Train becomes defensive. Yeah, but they don't understand. If you know about Steve Forrest and the SWAT team, they kill people like fly swatters, like flies. That's what they did in Vietnam. They put people into a room like this and SWAT. And you can laugh nervously now, but that's what they did. Men, women, and children. They didn't give a shit. Most of the young people have never seen Phil Oakes perform and know him only from his records. Some are surprised, most confused. Train launches into a tirade about William Colby. The guy in charge of the program was Colby, the head of the CIA. I put out a contract on Colby for $100,000. I told Colby he's got a half year to get out or he's dead. They can kill me, but he's dead. He's a dead man now. William Colby is dead. Unless he quits, commits suicide, gets a convenient disease, or resigns, all right? Hard to believe, but true, all right? In the meantime, you'll hear the best song written in the 70s about Patty Hearst, a girl I don't particularly like, but for some reason he likes her, so we'll hear the song. Walker sings. Several orange juice and rums later, a chair is placed on the tiny stage and Train, carrying his guitar like a .45 Magnum, eases himself into the saddle. He hitches his feet to the rail of the stool. Now, as you might have heard, I've gone through a minor change of life. You might have known me as Phil Oakes. You're now seeing the last show of Phil Oakes. He rolls up his right sleeve as if he were a doctor about to perform surgery or a drugger about to shoot up. Tonight at 8 and at midnight. As of tomorrow, my name is officially changed. John Train. John Train is John Wayne. John Ford. I'm known as Howard Hughes Jr. I'm known as the outlaw. I live outside the law. I have no respect for the law. I've got no respect for any human being alive in this room. I'll kill you all as soon as look at you. Believe me, I will. I've got a hammer. Where's my hammer? Train gets off the stool and reaches behind for his hammer, a large claw with a black rubber grip. He holds it and warns, I don't trust nobody. I don't trust any woman. I consider all women, well, I won't use the word, you know what I think they are. He tries to put the hammer under his belt as if it were a pistol. He sucks in, but the hammer won't slide. He tries again, and someone yells from the audience, what's the matter, hemorrhoids? Train tries to focus through the spots, but finally gives up and dismisses the crack with an almost wistful, no hemorrhoids. He puts the hammer behind him, then he strums an E bass, a chord, and has another drink. Starting tomorrow, I'm the bartender at my own bar. I own 80% of my own bar, and it's called Che, after Che Guevara. Smattering of applause. Better known in some circles as Ernesto Guevara, an Argentine doctor who gave up his life for you assholes. You're all middle class enough to afford $5 I charge for this show, but it's the last time you'll ever see me. Next time I see you, I'll see you dead or with a gun. I've taken a contract on William Colby, the head of the CIA. He's dead in 6 months unless he quits. This is it, life and death. You can laugh nervously. Anybody come up to me tomorrow and says, are you Phil Oakes? You get the hammer in the old temple. You're dead, all right? You get a broken arm, a broken leg. That's it. But tonight, you get the last of Phil Oakes. But even Phil Oakes doesn't want to be Phil Oakes anymore. His head rolls to one side. He strums a G chord in the familiar tra-la-la, tra-la-la, tra-la-la of Dylan's Mr. Tambourine Man. Now, I know the most beautiful woman in the audience tonight wouldn't be reading Penthouse Magazine. She'd be reading Twang. His right hand slips off the top of the neck and drags down the strings. That awful cunt paper, Ms., run by that CIA agent, what's her name? Steinem. CIA Steinem. I called Gloria Steinem last week. I said, Gloria, how about you and me, babes? We already have National Secretary Week where every secretary gets to play the role of executive. Every executive gets to play the role of secretary, just for the sake of argument, for all you feminists, re-counter-revolutionary pink pig cunts, Tanya's that kill Che's, he becomes Steinem. Gee, Phil, that's too strong for us. That's too strong for Ms. Magazine to demand that. I said, fuck you, Gloria, you're full of shit. The noise from the bar increases. Train breaks from his story and shouts, hey, hold it down, I'm trying to make a serious statement here. From somewhere in the back, it's not very serious. It's very serious. It's not very serious. Who are you? Come up on stage, pal, Mr. Serious, Mr. Not Very Serious. Come up on stage right now. No reply. Hey, idiot, come up on stage right now. Still nothing. The faces of the young girls down front twist with confusion. Their eyes are pasted to the arrogant Hulk on stage. Chicken shit. I'll sing, asshole. When he finally does start to sing, it is not Phil Oakes music, but Johnny Cash songs, a medley of the country western balladeer's best tunes. Train, with what is left of Oakes' voice, rasps a low register and air tones the highs, vainly searching for a way to make the throat work again. It hasn't been the same since the accident in Africa. The spiraling sensuality is lost forever. Train introduces what he calls the last Phil Oakes song. Here's a song about Sonny Liston. Boxer. Well, I don't know how Sonny Liston died. Maybe he killed himself. Maybe he even tried. Or maybe the boys weren't satisfied. I don't know. I'm sorry, I just don't know. Sonny, 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 why'd you have to take a dive? If you don't, then you won't be alive. From Sonny, he segues into the last song of the first set, There But For Fortune. That was one of his more famous songs. Naughty bulges show from beneath the skin of his thick and wrinkled neck. The song over. He wasn't that old. I mean, he was in his 30s, like 35 here. The song over, he staggers off the stage and heads for the bathroom where he holds himself up in front of the wash basin, his eyes shut tightly, his piss running down the side of his pants. The hat comes off for the second show. The eyes are a bit clearer, the voice shyly sweeter. For openers, he croons a Sinatra, bringing a chuckle from the midnight crowd. And now the end is near. It's my way, I think. Train's final curtain. Good to see you, Phil, someone shouts. Train responds with Sonny Liston, followed by the Johnny Cash set. His vocal cords are iced and slippery. The high notes, still out of reach, are easier to fake. Midway through Cash's There You Go, you're going to break another heart, you're going to tell another lie. He calls for another drink. When nothing comes from the bar, he angrily throws his guitar down and walks off the stage. A drink is quickly passed over the heads of the crowd. When it reaches Train, he holds it up triumphantly to cheers. Minutes drag on while Train tries to retune his guitar. Its neck has split. Out of the confusion of the tuning, Train bursts into song. Found him by the stage last night. He was breathing his last breath. A bottle of gin and a cigarette were all that he had left. I can see that you make the music because you carry your guitar, but God help the troubadour who tries to be a star. I think that's one of his songs. Train travels through old folk songs, Irish ballads, Western tunes, Whispering Pines, Bachelor Till I Die, Sea of Heartbreak, 8 More Miles to Louisville, Maybe Tomorrow. Back to the roots, back to the days at the military academy where young Phil Oakes first became addicted to the flinty sound of country western. It's as if Oakes' life is flashing before Train's eyes. As you know, this is my final performance. You'll never see me again. I formed a company called Barricade Limited. If you watch Channel D, D for Death, you'll see one of the first Barricade movies, Coup d'etat in America. It shows the 15 guys who killed JFK. I know nobody's particularly interested. I called up the New York Times and said, hey, you're full of shit. All the news that's fit to print except who killed John Kennedy. Is that the story? Hey, man, we've been investigating since... Fuck you, man. Watch television. It's on the air. Names, dates, faces. Frank Sturgis shot John F. Kennedy with his pal E. Howard Hunt and 13 Cuban assholes. In case you're interested, I'm sure you're not. For his final song of the evening, he chooses Crucifixion. Which is, that's off the album I played on my show. That's off of Pleasures of the Harbor. It's about the assassination of Kennedy, more or less. It's the last song he'll ever perform for pay. It is over at 3:15 in the morning. Train lifts the guitar slowly over his head. He whispers adios into the mic. While the crowd cheers and stands, he walks past the bar and out the door, down by McDougal, over to Houston, on past Worcester, until he drops asleep in a filthy alley between two buildings somewhere in Soho. He would give himself another 8 months of life, and then off it. Before the end, Train would careen through Oak's last days, getting arrested, threatening friends, beating up men and women. Finally, on a cold, shadowless morning in January 1976, John Train, the highest of highs, evaporated, and what was left of Phil Oakes tried to renew the lease on his soul. The last months were the loneliness. Convinced that as John Train he'd gone too far, with quiet determination, on Friday, April 9th, he hanged himself to death.
Dreams from My Father, A Story of Race and Inheritance. It was written in 1995. A long time before anything. It's been 6 years since that first trip to Kenya, and much in the world has changed. For me, it's been a relatively quiet period, less a time of discovery than of consolidation, of doing the things that we tell ourselves we finally must do to grow up. I went to Harvard Law School, spending most of 3 years in poorly lit libraries, poring through cases and statutes. The study of law can be disappointing at times, a matter of applying narrow rules and arcane procedures to an uncooperating reality, a sort of glorified accounting that serves to regulate the affairs of those who have power, and that all too often seeks to explain to those who do not the ultimate wisdom and justness of their condition. But that's not all the law is. The law is also a memory. The law also records a long-running conversation, a nation arguing with its conscience. We hold these truths to be self-evident. In those words, I hear the spirit of Douglas and Delaney, as well as Jefferson and Lincoln, the struggles of Martin and Malcolm, and unheralded marchers to bring these words to life. I hear the voices of Japanese families interned behind barbed wire, young Russian Jews cutting patterns in Lower East Side sweatshops, Dust Bowl farmers loading up their trucks with the remains of shattered lives. I hear the voices of the people in Altgeld Gardens in Chicago. He talks about them before. I think that's the projects in Chicago. And the voices of those who stand outside this country's borders, the weary, hungry bands crossing the Rio Grande. I hear all of these voices clamoring for recognition, all of them asking the very same questions that have come to shape my life, the same questions that I sometimes, late at night, find myself asking the old man. What is our community, and how might that community be reconciled with our freedom? How far do our obligations reach? How do we transform mere power into justice, mere sentiment into love? The answers I find in law books don't always satisfy me. For every Brown v. Board of Education, I find a score of cases where conscience is sacrificed to expedience or greed. And yet, in the conversation itself, in the joining of voices, I find myself modestly encouraged, believing that so long as the questions are still being asked, what binds us together might somehow ultimately prevail. That faith, so different from innocence, can sometimes be hard to sustain. Upon my return to Chicago, I would find the signs of decay accelerated throughout the South Side. The unions breaking down and the factories and stuff. Because that was who we really worked with through the 80s and stuff, where factories that had closed down and stuff. The neighborhood shabbier, the children edgier and less restrained, more middle-class families heading out to the suburbs, the jails bursting with glowering youth, glowery my brothers without prospects. All too rarely do I hear people asking just what it is that we've done to make so many children's hearts so hard, or what collectively we might do to make to right their moral compass, what values we must live by. All too rarely do I hear people asking just what it is that we've done to make so many children's hearts so hard, or what we collectively might do to right their moral compass, what values we must live by. Instead, I see us doing what we've always done, pretending that these children are somehow not our own. I try to do my small part in reversing this tide. In my legal practice, I work mostly with churches and community groups, men and women who quietly build grocery stores and health clinics in the inner city and housing for the poor. Every so often, I'll find myself working on a discrimination case representing clients who show up at my law firm's office with stories that we like to tell ourselves should no longer exist. Most of these clients are slightly embarrassed by what's happened to them, as are the white coworkers who agree to testify on their behalf. No one wants to be known as a troublemaker. And yet at some point, both plaintiff and witness decide that a principle is at stake, that despite everything that has happened, those words put to paper over 200 years ago must mean something after all. Black and white, they make their claim on this community we call America. They choose our better history. Jiu Taiku!
Thoughts fly apart, body unhinges, a new leaf unfolds. Bereft, transient of all things, a broken chain. Plastic garbage bag, dog hopes for treats, sudden love affair. Sack of peanuts, visitor raids my store, beak by beak. Alas, a farewell, I stand at the gate and wish. Stretch the night into sunstream, row the soothes the smooth sounds of now, a choir of birds and sassafras. Still a bird sings, morning breaks to a lone song, distant crow responds. Body wakes, mind wakes, heart longs for infinity. A thousand haiku trickle down the mountainside, morning shower.
That one reminded me of cherry blossoms.
Body levitates, my only response is to laugh. That's the one that got me. What the fuck are you doing, Jude?
Yeah.
Crap. One more day till dawn, two more days till morning, then suddenly, yesterday. Roll awake, softly merge with morn. If it's attached, it's your body.
A Lunar Questionnaire by Recomonte. Where do the wild ones go to heal their paws and hands? Can God be both host and guest at this never-ending shindig? When will the maze dwellers matriculate? Why is the salt of compassion so often added late? Pick one, back, head, or heartache. Isn't it about time to rejoice in the sensory encryption? In the physics of love, is the shortest distance a look in the eye? Have you seen Grace lately? What was she wearing under her bones? Will the blue veins beneath the skin form a link to constellations? How much does it cost to park a bus, to park the bus as far from the hypocrisy as possible? If the wonder ever leaves, will you find that also wondrous? Does the shattering of habit plant seeds amidst the rebel? At what address did glory ever fail to show? Animal, vegetable, or meteor? Where from issues the fires of renewal, if not in today's first earful? And is the time spent waiting in need of finer calibration? Why, that's nice. Why does the earth taste like, what does the earth taste like to the trillion-tongued sun? Why does your psyche taste like cinnamon? What's the deal with a leader with no ladder to the rooftop? How goes it with the sloughing of yesterday's cramps and groans? Can't the piece of a single candle be fused to each annihilation? Whoops. Can't the piece of a single candle be fused to each inhalation? Well, quite a different ending to that poem. can't the piece of a single candle be fused to each inhalation. I'm going to read the closing of this Azure journal. So the last afternoon in Ollantay Tambo, Grateful Bear and I ascended to the viewpoint parallel the ruins, those very same ruins that had moved us so deeply in the following journal entry. And this is a June 21st entry, and he's recalling this February 11th entry. A soft wind blows warmly up the crevasse perpendicular to the sacred valley where Ollantaytambo is situated. I think we will spend several days here. I'm quite moved by the people and the pace of life here. An even gentler wind blows through my soul this evening as we watch the sunset over the splendor of a valley. After our arrival by Colectivo from Pisac via Urubamba, we made our way through labyrinthine chasms of stone and soil, skipping over drainage rivulets from off the mountain stream of the Montana de Santa Marta. Gazing up the crevasse eastward, up the valley of the Santa Marta, an immense calm suffused my body and off-weary heart. There was a sense of sacred space here, perhaps in the heart of the people. Who was it that wrote, "The soul of a place is its people"? I feel myself drawn up the valley, drifting in a world of folk reveries and smiling faces, dark-skinned and hiking up the valley with ease. To be here is to feel human again. End of recall. Yeah. Exhausted, we again sat on the same crag, stringing the arched hyperbolic skew of the bowing parallel, slipped off the mountainside. Standing on feet suspended touchless above the beckoning fingers of the earth's bittersweet caress, then reaching out my hand and taking mine into hers. And he then quotes a long passage from Parmenides, which reads, "The mares which carry me as far as my spirit ever aspired were escorting me when they brought me and proceeded along the renowned road of the goddess, which brings a knowing mortal to all cities one by one. On this path I was being brought, on it wise mares were bringing me, straining the chariot, and maidens were guiding the way. Did the maidens guide the horses and the car on the broad way, and the goddess received me gladly and took in her hand my right hand and addressed to me the following words. O young man, coming to our abode joined with immortal charioteers, with the horses which carry you, welcome. Since it was not an evil destiny that sent you forth to travel this road, for indeed it is far from the beaten path of humans, but right and justice. There is need for you to learn all things, both the unshaken heart of persuasive truth and the opinions of mortals in which there is no true reliance. But nevertheless you will learn these two, that the things that appear must genuinely be always indeed all things. And looking about in a circle with wordless wonder, truly now and forever, I saw into the face of the world around me, worn with suffering and touching the earth in this place, and knew I would never be once moved, though the stone should wither and the world should pass away. Inevitably, though the arrow arches in a wild blindness, carrying along it cannot help but find rest in its return. Unmoved, what? Yeah. Unmoved, we never visited the ruin at Ollantaytambo. I turned about and walked down the mountain. It was time to return home. That afternoon, we returned up the valley to Cusco, again ascending the ridge through Chinchero. Beauty struck me all around in sheltered intimations like a flickering candle cradled in the windy night. That night proceeded dreamless, a white and silken blanket of unwritten words across a weary canvas. The next morning I proceeded slowly with a tempered and evolving urgency once again to the San Pedro market. Through the stampede of revelers celebrating the solstice and rebirth of the sun, the most holy of events in Incan cosmology, I took a moment's rest at a bench. Carrying his box of work supplies and walking directly in my direction, a young boy tapping my shoe asked, "Shoe sign, mister?" And this moment spilled into the future alone in the hostel room. My vertigo labyrinthitis, relics of my refusal to return from India, flared through fontanelles and soft wisps of baby's breath on my bald head. Looking about in a circle, the walls crashing in about me, body, space, and time entirely alien and barren, abandoned on this earthen wasteland but a seed planted inside, a seed whose growth precludes a concealing, covered with a dark earth only ever rich for its lack of tending, a strange planet, a planet to which we do not belong, our roots go much deeper, yet sprouting, bringing sensory experience into full and conscious focus. Pulling out several tins of colored powder, he took a rag and wiped away a first and thinning layer of dust, beneath revealing a soft tone of skin. His hands black with polish and the aromatic vapor of turpentine escaping morning's coil and splinters of sunlight across the fading stone of the market basin. My feet, bathed in the sweet touch of a childhood both profane and holy, stood at the mother's head and looking down. Taking the tins of powder and nimbly lifting raised whiffs of each color on the edge of his finger, then smearing in colors, he closed the container and shaking it vigorously opened it back up. You like this color, Meester? With face upturned and eyes locked across moments passing, baffled and laughing, sometimes I am the one standing still and conscious of the suffering at my feet, yet still, somehow, the one suffering and at the feet of the beloved. Except that you become as one of these, colors mixed in a cheap tin, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and first earth had passed away, and there was no longer the sea. Revelation 21:1. Consummatum est, it is finished. What then next? A story become aware of itself and changes without me. What then next? Each character is caught in a tangle of events and decisions, each commanded some moments and dragged along by others. Each is passing and deepening labyrinthine story toward what? Any? Yes, toward, for fiction allows a propulsion, a shaping and speeding of events toward. Much as there are tangents, there is toward, or towards. I live in these pages as much as outside them. We are not separate in any meaningful way. When I open this book, we together resume, but other times you both live on. This world, its unknown autonomies as mine. A question I've wondered often, is this book's world, this series of books' worlds, mine own, or is it otherwise? In mine, a major war is happening in the Middle East, a horrific disaster created by a powerful, mediocre man. My race's planet is suffering by her abuse and tries to stop the coming calamity, have not succeeded yet. Would this book's world resonate more or less by each parallel it bears with my world? My book, my own knowledge, knows truths, propels by truths, only some in my world believed. The world was not contrived in 7 days by a god-man who later created a man-god to punish and punish again humanity, who in turn punished and punished again each other and all other existence on Earth. This book believes in the existence of non-human intelligent life, in the powerful reality of dreams, the great tool psychedelia in its many forms, the sentient of trees and other plants, animals, oceans, mountain cliffs, lightning, dusks, the unity of mind and body, call this unity soul, and the continuance of each beyond their dissolving hour, bodies to feed back into the soil, minds to move along elsewhere, somewhere. Yet, is this a different world or simply the prejudices of the pen-wielder? What is the bridge of glass, the white woods? What is Lunatee's Cafe or the amphitheater deep within it? What is remote land or was Triptown? Are these simply pages or more? What for? What toward? A gesture, a flick, a movement in and out of shadows, swiftly, and each is again dispatched to his and her labyrinthine place, a clue given, now carry along without a misstep. Mr. Bob the barman fetches me my pale blue Dallas Cowboys mug full of diet soda and ice. I nod, smile at him, he returns my gesture. On the TV mounted behind the bar in the corner, a fire bursts out, spitting its sparks beyond the screen, spelling, "Sing deeper." Okay, is that it? That concludes this meeting. Now we're going to watch The Mighty Boosh. Thank you all, and good night.